Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Nonprofit Coach Podcast. Since 2010, the most listened to show in the nonprofit sector, dedicated to helping your charity succeed. It's no secret that combining online and offline techniques is the key to fundraising success, and practical nonprofit management advice is what you need. The Nonprofit Coach Podcast with Ted Hart is the perfect landing point to learn from experts around the world who provide advice you can use. Ted Hart is, without a doubt, one of the foremost nonprofit thought leaders. Also a successful author, his books range from successful online fundraising to expert nonprofit management. Guests on the Nonprofit Podcast are leaders in their field who share their insider tips and trade secrets in a conversational style both the experienced and novice will benefit from. Ted and his guests help you and your organization move to greater levels of efficiency and fundraising success. Ted lectures around the world, but now he's here for you. After the show, you can find all of our podcasts at tedhart.com, on iTunes, and now just say, Alexa, play Nonprofit Coach on TuneIn. Now, welcome the host of the Nonprofit Coach Podcast, Ted Hart.
And welcome here to the Nonprofit Coach Podcast. Thank you for joining us today. We've got a very full show. As you know, we always start with page one news. You can also follow us along over on Facebook today at facebook.com/ Ted Hart. So we're going to head right on over to page one news. First up here on page one news is Ashley Gatewood. Ashley is the Communications and Marketing Manager at CFRE International. Ashley, welcome back here to the Nonprofit Coach Podcast, and please bring us up to date with CFRE International.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me back. It's great to talk to your listenership again. Our most pressing thing, I would say, at CFRE is that on July 15th is our next application deadline. So if any of your listeners are working on putting their application together, take advantage of the next 2.5 weeks, polish it up, and submit it. I know in the past we've done many extensions of our application deadlines, but this one will not be extended, and it will be a firm July 15th. And for folks that are out and about at conferences, we will be at the Virginia Fundraising Institute next month exhibiting, and I will be presenting the CFRE exam, Setting Yourself Up for Success session. And for your European listeners, we will be exhibiting at Case Europe in Birmingham in England in August, and our CEO and President Eva Aldrich will be on hand there to answer your questions.
That's terrific. That's terrific. How do you look in terms of numbers these days? How many folks are holding the CFRE certification?
Great question. Yes, we're over 6,500 CFREs right now worldwide, which is a great number for us. We just had a testing window close on June 15th, and we had 202 new CFREs out of that batch. And also a great stat for us as well is that 48% of those were millennials. So we are seeing more millennials step up and take charge of their career and move forward with the CFRE.
Well, terrific. Well, as you know, the Nonprofit Coach Podcast highly recommends anyone in the fundraising profession who is qualified to sit, which, correct me if I'm wrong, that means you've completed 5 years of professional work in fundraising. Is that right?
It is to have worked 36 months in the most recent 5 years.
36 months.
Mm-hmm.
And in the most recent 5 years. So anyway, go to CFRE.org. We've put the link up over at facebook.com/ Ted Hart so that you can learn if you qualify. And if you do, I think it says an awful lot about you to volunteer yourself to sit for exam and to become certified like your other professional peers because that certainly helps build trust with donors and certainly provides guidance to nonprofit organizations that want to avail themselves of professional fundraising techniques. So, Ashley Gatewood, thank you again for joining us here on the Nonprofit Coach and providing us with that page one update. Next
great
up here on page one news, you bet, Ashley, anytime. We always look forward to having you back here. Supriya Kumar is joining us with a brand new offering here on the Nonprofit Coach because of the linkage between GuideStar and the Foundation Center, now an organization called Candid, has been formed. And so we have the new Candid Corner. So, Supriya Kumar, please introduce us to the Candid Corner and bring us up to date with what's happening at GuideStar and the Foundation Center.
Sure. Thanks for having me. Yes, as you mentioned, Foundation Center and GuideStar recently, in the past few months, have joined forces, and so we're now one organization called Candid. And joining the forces was just the start of it. We're right now busy combining operations. There's a whole number of projects going through, and we're getting excited about new projects up and coming. So the work remains the same. We're still doing the same work Foundation Center and GuideStar have been doing, and you can still come to us for the same resources. But there are new exciting projects coming out soon as well. And in particular, I did want to talk about a recent report we just launched last month. We looked at how U.S. households have been giving to disasters in 2017 and 2018. And this work was done in partnership with the Center for Disaster Philanthropy and the Indiana University Lilly Family School of Philanthropy. And what we found was that 30% of U.S. households have been making disaster-related donations, specifically in 2017 and 2018. So it's very exciting new findings for us. We've been very focused on how philanthropy has been engaging in this topic with the Center for Disaster Philanthropy. So it was really exciting and interesting to see how U.S. households have been responding to disasters as well.
That's terrific. Well, it's always good to be able to avail ourselves of new research. What else is going on at Candid?
We also just kicked off a great campaign to encourage nonprofits to claim and update their nonprofit profile on GuideStar. It's called the Summer Sprint, and organizations have until midnight this Friday, June 28th, to update and earn a new seal of transparency. We'll then select winners at random to receive up to a $500 donation to their organization. So if anyone is interested in participating, you can go to guidestar.org/update to get started.
Well, that's terrific. Well, we will post that over at facebook.com/TedHart as a way to remind folks that participating in this summer dash to get updated, because here at the Nonprofit Coach, we always encourage nonprofit organizations to provide transparent information. GuideStar gives you that running start because they have your information loaded from your 990s, but it's incumbent upon organizations to go in and use the templates to be able to share a more complete picture of your nonprofit organization. And what percentage of charities, I understand it's quite low. We've been working for years to try to get the number up, but what percentage of charities represented on GuideStar currently are updating their information on a regular basis?
I'm actually not quite sure on the exact number. I'll have to get back to you on that.
Well, we appreciate that. I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but I think the last time I looked, it may be somewhere. No, sorry. I think the reason I asked that question is last time I looked, I think it was somewhere around 10 to 12%, which is just really not large enough when we all say as in nonprofit organizations that we want donors to trust us. We want donors to understand how important it is to give to nonprofit organizations. And here is an organization, part of Candid, GuideStar, that provides you with an easy way to tell that story, and you need to avail yourselves of that. So I also want to post the link to the U.S. Household Disaster Giving. This was just posted in May. Is that the report that you're referring to It's over
that's
on your
correct.
Issue lab by Candid. Yeah.
Yes, that's
so we're going to post
exactly right.
the link to that as well so that everyone can avail themselves of that and what lessons can be learned about household giving at time of disaster. So again, wonderful to have you here, Supriya, providing us with the new Candid Corner. We look forward to having you back here on the Nonprofit Coach podcast.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Great job. All right. We are ready to get on over to our page two expert. Our page two expert today is Patrick Schmidt. He is a leading innovator in the field of fundraising and social impact. Between 2009 and 2010, Patrick ran email fundraising for President Obama, where his team invented many of the existing best practices in digital fundraising. He served as a head of innovation at Change.org, helping to grow that organization to 200 million members in just 4 years. Patrick is now the co-founder of FreeWill, a social venture that has helped organizations raise more than $650 million in new planned gifts and qualified charitable donations. Patrick and his co-founder, Jenny, were recently named two of the top 50 philanthropists in the world by Town and Country. Patrick received his Bachelor's of Science right here in Washington, D.C. at Georgetown University, and his MBA out on the West Coast at Stanford University. And it is my pleasure to welcome Patrick Schmidt here to the Nonprofit Coach podcast. Welcome, Patrick.
Thank you, Ted. I'm really excited to be here.
Patrick, we're excited to have you because you certainly sit at a vantage point of understanding philanthropy and understanding what makes and motivates people to give to causes that matter to them most. Can you share with us, start off with, how did you end up with all of your background in philanthropy? Why philanthropy?
Yeah. So I've always been very interested in social impact. And I wanted to be work at Amnesty International or be a human rights lawyer. And there was something that was really striking to me when I was in college, actually, to start. So I joined, in the early days, a group called STAND, which was just a college club at Georgetown, the way that any college has dozens. And we were really focused on advocacy and work around what was happening in Sudan at the time, in Darfur. So this is about 2004, 2005. We made a website, which wasn't an obvious decision at the time. It's hard to imagine that was only 15 years ago. And we got some early media attention, and within 6 months, there were 1,200 chapters of this organization called STAND in a dozen countries. And we were able to pass legislation through U.S. Congress and raise millions of dollars for relief and do a lot of other things. We certainly made a lot of mistakes, but it was eye-opening to me to see that people like me, who I thought of as relatively ordinary, could have an enormous impact with some effort and the right technology and ambitious goals. And you mentioned in the biography, I moved from online organizing into email fundraising and led that for 2 years for President Obama after his first election. And so working through the event, the Affordable Care Act and other things like that. And really the idea that you can use philanthropy as a way to help ordinary people achieve their goals in aggregate they wouldn't be able to do themselves was really exciting to me. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about how do you help normal people change the world? And that's brought me here.
That's right. Patrick, regardless of what your political stripes might be, arguably the Obama campaign and Change.org itself are known in the sector to be among the most successful in being able to take a message and motivate people, as you say, to make change in their own lives, to make change in their communities and in their country. For our listeners here, which are nonprofit executives, primarily fundraisers, CEOs, and others who want to do precisely that. They want to make a difference in their community, for their nonprofits, and in their country. What are some of the key lessons that you learned in really sort of cutting your teeth on such important high-profile campaigns that are relevant to our listeners today?
That is a great question. I would really pull out three lessons from both of that work, and really what obviously we stood on the shoulders of other giants who were innovating in the field. And three keys in effective motivation to action are probably one, extreme clarity. People undervalue how important it is to be exceptionally clear about what you're trying to achieve and how you're going to do it. The second one would be ease. And this is really undervalued, I think, especially in the major giving and the planned giving world. But because we have so much access to data, we tell that when easier donations will go up by 20 or 25%, right? And this would mean removing a field or two from a credit card form, or making a button a little bit larger or more clear on the page. And you might think someone's going to give.
Did you say
or
ease?
Not.
Did you say ease of use for number two?
Yes, making it extremely easy. And just to give
so
you a quick story here.
Go ahead. Into the donor experience and how easy is it to find the way to give and then actually be able to conclude your giving?
Exactly.
Okay.
And then third, I think, is helping people understand that this is something that people like them do. And the big shift at change.org, for instance, which is an online petition platform where individuals lead social change efforts, large or small, is when we started aggressively telling stories of people who were having successful campaigns. And then suddenly people realized that folks like them could change. And seeing people like them take similar actions is just so built into who we are as humans that it is not just important, but it may be totally necessary in any effective campaign.
Okay. So, Patrick, let me explore this because I just want to confirm that I've got this right. So three main points if you're going to be successful online. First is clarity of your message. Two, it's easy for me to do what I want. And I think those two, whether charities get them right or not, I think they understand those at a very simple level. But then you bring in number three, which is not necessarily always thought of as equal to the other two, and that is, I've written it down here, is helping you to understand that others are doing the same thing, that you're not the only one who's doing this. So that would seem to suggest to me that you believe successful fundraising, successful efforts of this sort are truly group activities. These are community activities that I'm more likely to do what you want me to do if I don't feel like I'm going it alone, but that I'm joining in with others.
Ted, that's exactly right. And so I would restate it as follows. One, it has to be a group activity. Two, it has to seem almost normal. This is something that people like me do.
I'm typing this down to make sure that we get this out on Facebook, because I think this is so powerful. And when you think of it, when you say those words, and my listeners are listening today, furiously taking notes so they can succeed in their next email campaign. We know these things are true, and we know these things are true because we've either been part of these campaigns or we see the kind of success of those campaigns. But it also is mirrored in things like corporate for-profit work as well. For instance, if you go to Amazon, one of the secrets to Amazon's success is to say, others who have bought this have bought this. And so it's guiding you exactly where you're suggesting here is, it's clear what I want you to do. It's very easy for you to do it. And you're not the only one who's buying this product. And in fact, you might want to buy more stuff because people just like you who bought what you say you're interested in also bought these things. So it's that, as you said, group activity. People like me do these things. It's very normal and natural for me to feel the way that I'm feeling and to take the action that I'm taking.
That's exactly right. And I think your analogy the for-profit world is spot on, right? Anyone who has access to vast amounts of data can be 6 or 7 donors.
Yeah. So let's make this very practical, because here on the Nonprofit Coach, that's what we're known for, is, you know, for large and small nonprofits, smaller nonprofits who may not have access to, you know, very expensive, very skilled consultants like you, but want to make a difference in their community, need to raise the money to be able to do the things that they do. This doesn't have to be a massive campaign, right? Because one of the things that I've often tried to get people to understand is that while this is new technology, it's not new thinking. Because if you go back to the earliest founding of American fundraising in colonial America or before, it was the neighborhood block party. It was people coming together. It was neighbors coming together. It was the community chest. It was the sense that you're supporting important causes, but you're not doing it alone. And it's by combining our efforts that we can do so much more. Because I think that the average donor, now we're not talking about, you know, multi-billionaires here who literally can fund an entire campaign themselves, who can move the needle all by themselves, but the average person who sees a need and wants to meet that need, they see someone who's homeless, or they see a neighborhood that needs revitalization, or they see a group of children who need to be educated, or a museum that needs to keep its doors open. Can I actually do that myself? Can I imagine myself doing that myself? And the answer is probably no. But in a successful campaign that you're talking about, what your job is in that campaign is to say you're not going it alone, and in fact, good people like you are doing this.
That's exactly right. And then moving into the ease point, thinking about how not just to make very small donor going into this on things like text to give or online credit card forms. That's incredibly important. I mean, we could talk more about why that dynamic is, but actually it's very difficult for most people to make planned gifts, to make gifts of stock or mutual funds, to make qualified charitable distributions, which I know we'll talk about in a bit, and how to make that process easier, because those gifts can be 10 or 1,000 times larger, is also critical at the same time.
That's right. And understanding how that works. So, you know, I often quip that, you know, the average nonprofit professional believes that they're going to actually get a significant planned gift as soon as they go to one more seminar. They just need to go to one more seminar, and then I'm going to get a big gift. And the reality here is that you and free will, and I want to talk a little bit about free will, are making it more accessible to charities of all sizes to truly understand the concept of planned giving, which anybody who's involved with fundraising knows that can significantly move the needle when you're talking about legacy giving versus annual giving. But it's so complex and is so tied to the legal aspects of the tax code as opposed to just the charitable deductible aspects of the tax code that for most nonprofit executives, it seems far too complex. What have you done to make it possible for more charities to get over that scariness hurdle, if you will, that legalese hurdle, and get it right and make a difference and give real Americans the opportunity to leave a true legacy?
It's a great question. We spent, before building Free Will, my co-founder, Jenny Spradling, who's actually off on her honeymoon right now, otherwise she'd probably join us on this show, she and I interviewed hundreds of non-hundreds of baby boomers, why planned giving wasn't even larger. Most people realize it's almost $40 billion a year, which is dramatically larger than corporate giving in totality, and about two-thirds of all foundation giving. It's pretty extraordinary. We realized there's two problems from a donor standpoint that nonprofits can actually step into. And then third, we'll talk about the complexity for donors, or for nonprofits, excuse me. But for donors, there are two big things. One is that people really don't know where to start on planned giving or even estate planning. I routinely talk to planned giving officers who don't have an estate plan in place. I talk to parents, I talk to academics. We interviewed a literal rocket scientist out of Stanford who never wanted to even think about having an estate plan. So helping people start the process in a way that's warm and comfortable is key. The second challenge, which really surprised us, and I think really surprised a lot of folks that we've spoken to, is how at all. And Dr. Russell James has noted
every so often, I'm not sure if you're on your cell phone, you cut out and your words are not easy to understand. So sometimes I jump in to ask you to clarify something because we actually didn't get the words. So if you could just go back slightly and help us understand it after you said, majority of people, do not have estate plans. Just pick it up from there.
Happy to. Thanks for clarifying that. And I'll make sure to speak a little bit more into the microphone. So what we saw is that the vast majority of people do not have estate plans at all. And we're stunned at how often we talk to plan giving officers even who don't have an estate plan in place. And we've interviewed tons of smart, educated, in many cases wealthy folks, many with kids or even grandkids who don't have an estate plan in place. And it's because people really big problem one. The second large problem is how rare it is for charitable giving to be prompted during the estate planning process. And what we've seen from interviews is that as many as 80 or 90% of people who did have estate plans were not asked about charitable giving during that process. This is true for both attorneys and for things like LegalZoom and Rocket Lawyer, which are becoming increasingly prominent.
Right, and that's not necessarily on the charity, because the charity may not be part of that discussion. That's more on the part of getting the word out to attorneys and to CPAs, who are the hired professionals to help put those documents together oftentimes. That if they don't raise it, then the point here is that a lot of Americans are not asking that question themselves because it's not occurring to them. You wrote, I just want to draw our attention to our listeners, you were interviewed and you were part of a story that ran late last year in Forbes magazine. We're going to post this over on facebook.com/Ted Hart. And what's quoted in this article is exactly what you're saying now, is that fewer than 30% of Americans have gotten around to making wills in their lifetime. That's 70% of Americans don't have a will. And then even less is the 5% of individuals who include charitable giving in their estate plan. So we're talking about a very small number of people who are probably philanthropists during their lifetime, who are probably giving and care about causes in their lifetime, who don't understand how they can, because their professionals may not be raising it or may not make it seem that that's something they actually can accomplish in their wills. And 70% of people don't have a will anyway.
Exactly. And we think these dynamics are costing the nonprofit sector at least $100 billion every year. And the way that we've thought about tackling it is we make intuitive and easy. And what if we put charitable giving front and center during that process? And so what we've done is we've created estate planning tools that are totally free for individuals that they can either use to make an estate plan online, similar to a Rocket Lawyer or a LegalZoom, or really start the process and bring it to an attorney. We're thrilled with both outcomes. Mm-hmm. And by doing both of those things, we're stunned by the results. So to date, about 60,000 people have done their plans through free will. Those people have committed $660 million in charitable gifts. Most of this is in the last year.
Say that again. I mean, good on you. I mean, to break that logjam and to actually provide a tool that has already unlocked, give us that number again.
About $660 billion. So almost two-thirds, sorry, 660 million, excuse me. We're not at 660
million,
billion
million,
yet.
Million. And according to this article, and this number may have changed, so please correct me, is that the average bequest is worth $70,000. So this is very serious business for nonprofit organizations, and really should be one of the biggest topics that's discussed anywhere in fundraising today.
I think that's exactly right. That the average gift has gone up to about $83,000 as we continue to make improvements on the platform. And
well, and you attract more people. And that average is, of course, you know, built off from the number of people who are using your platform. So freewill.com, and we've posted that link as well. But, I mean, nothing in life can be free that's going to last. So you've created this tool. But how is freewill.com supported, making it possible for charities to unleash the philanthropy that people had in their hearts to begin with?
Totally. What we originally thought, let's charge users and we're paying $99 for a plan, and therefore weren't leaving a $400,000 bequest. And so everybody was losing out. And instead, our model is that we work with nonprofits. We work with more than 1,000, including every local United Way chapter, and folks like the Red Cross and the American Heart Association, all the way down to a local dog shelter. And we create custom versions of the tools that they can share with their own supporters. So those folks get access to new tools that they might not otherwise know about. And then those nonprofits are seeing incredible ROI in terms of new bequests. So it's been a joy to work with so many organizations, and we've been thrilled.
Now, in working with those charities, are you providing, you know, fee for service to customize specific parts of the document that makes it easier for donors of a particular organization to customize their support, or is this, you know, sort of one size fits all, but it still works?
It's a very bespoke approach. So we customize it for any individual charity to make giving extremely easy to that organization. Most people are getting outright gifts. We even work with a bunch of religious foundations who are setting up endowment gifts as well. And then we just offer a lot of marketing support and real-time data and analytics so that people can get smart about planned giving in a way that's been largely inaccessible in the past because the data around planned gifts is so poor generally.
That's right. Well, this is extremely important information for all nonprofit organizations and for all donors to be aware of. We're going to take a very quick break here. When we come back, what I'd like to ask Patrick Schmidt is to then share with us a new report on qualified charitable distributions. What are they? Why are they important? And why is that continuing this incredible legacy that he is bringing to the nonprofit sector? And we will be right back.
Remember, our podcasts and archives are always free and always available 24 hours a day at tedhart.com, on iTunes, and now just say, Alexa, play Nonprofit Coach on TuneIn. Now back to the Nonprofit Coach podcast with Ted Hart.
And we are here with Patrick Schmidt, and Patrick is not only the co-founder of FreeWill, .com that we have posted at facebook.com/Ted Hart, but is also author to a very important new report, the 2019 report on qualified charitable distributions from IRAs, what the fastest growing area of philanthropy means for your organization. So this is a publication of FreeWill, and specifically is giving information on how IRAs can be a source of charitable giving. So walk us through or start off with what is commonly known as the IRA charitable rollover for gifts, or the qualified charitable distribution, also known as QCD. So we have incredible ways to make things seem very complex. So break this down and let us know what is it.
Great. So let's first define what a qualified charitable distribution, or a QCD, is. And we commonly call it a QCD instead of an IRA charitable rollover, because when donors hear IRA rollover, they think, I left my job and I'm moving my 401k into a different account. And so coming back to the point of clarity earlier in the hour, that's how we think about it. A QCD, or qualified charitable distribution, is a gift directly from your IRA account. It's only eligible for folks who will be 70 and a half this year, this calendar year, and it goes directly from the account to the charity. It never goes to the individual's bank account, and that would trigger all sorts of this has become increasingly important in the last 3 years, or in the last year and a half, actually, to be specific. And it's because you see a dramatic decrease in the number of people who are itemizing deductions. And this is due to recent tax changes. So the number of people itemizing deductions has dropped from 30% to an estimated 10%, which is a massive shift. And most of those people are not over 70, because if you're not working, you're less likely to be itemizing deductions. And so QCDs can lower your taxes while caring for the causes you love, even if you're not itemizing deductions, which is why it's so important.
That's right. That's right. So, again, if those who are 70 and a half or older are required to take a required minimum distribution, and a QCD, or a qualified charitable distribution, can count towards that. And failing to take the required minimum distribution comes with a fine. And so one way to avoid that fine is to have some of those funds go directly to a charity as a qualified charitable distribution. Is that one of the benefits of utilizing a QCD?
That's a huge benefit. So it is the most tax-efficient way for many people over 70 to give, and it is an urgent activity in a world where not a lot of urgency happens. And so if you are a nonprofit, you need to help your donors do this every year.
In your report, you said of all nonprofits surveyed, 92% saw an increase in QCDs giving from 2017 to 2018. And again, that's probably tied to the changes in the tax law, which for many people, particularly middle-class folks, their effective ability to qualify for a charitable deduction was removed by that tax code. However, if you are 70 and a half or older, you now can create a charitable deduction for yourself by taking the funds from your IRA.
That's exactly right. And then on top of this, there are currently 10,000 baby boomers turning 70 every day, making 70 to 80-year-olds the fastest growing age bracket in the United States. And these are exactly the people that are becoming eligible for QCDs.
Now, I would imagine that for our average listener, as this increase in QCDs was happening, they all had to run to the internet or run to their legal counsel or run to their CPA to say, what is this? People are starting to send us contributions. They know a lot more about it than I do. So what do nonprofit organizations need to know, both in terms of accepting a QCD, but also perhaps marketing to their donor base to help them understand that you know how to accept a gift of this sort? What do you need to do?
Well, the first thing to note is that QCD giving is somewhat of a disaster right now, and it's because the banks are not prepared, donors are not educated about it, and most nonprofits don't know what to do. And so let's come back to the early principles of clarity, ease, and storytelling. And one, it's incumbent on nonprofits to help people who are not just new to the new tax code, but also maybe new to being over 70, that this is exactly the kind of gift that you want to be giving. The second category is making sure that it's very easy for folks. And so we've actually built a whole platform.
Let me stop you there, Patrick.
Go ahead, please.
Let me stop you there just because I want to put this in context, because what I try to do is draw analogies to things that people might already know or might be thinking so that we can help them not be scared of something that's new, but to see that they actually know how to do this. So in a similar context, the average fundraiser would be able to articulate to a donor why they would make a contribution of appreciated stock over writing a check, because they can tell the donor that they're going to not only get the qualify for a potential charitable deduction, but also to avoid capital gains. So what we need to do is help the average fundraiser learn the language here, and I'm just sort of leading up to where you left us, that a QCD now needs to be part of your lexicon for any one of your donors who, as you said, may be new to being 70, 70 and a half, and now have assets that they also need to know how to manage those from a philanthropic perspective, just as you would want to and be able to tell that story about appreciated stock.
This. You can give to the causes
Patrick,
you care about.
You broke up just a little bit. So you broke up just a little bit there. So did I get that right? Does that put it in context for the average fundraiser?
That's exactly right. I think the simplest way to state it, if you're an average fundraiser talking to a donor, is this is a way to care about the causes you love. Even if you're not itemizing deductions, you can still lower your taxes this way.
And that's going to matter, particularly since with the standard deduction being higher, there are fewer opportunities for people to qualify for additional tax relief, and even more so of an issue perhaps for states that have higher property taxes now that there is a cap on state and local tax deductions as well. So it's a new set of rules then, Patrick. It's a standard set of language that a fundraiser has to learn, because it's always been there, but the importance to a segment of your donors is even more important now than it has been before because of the changes in the tax code.
That's right. And then the next challenge is people say, okay, I'm convinced I'll do this. How do I do it? And the challenge is that all of the IRA custodians have different mechanisms for requesting qualified charitable distributions. And so Vanguard's a different approach than Fidelity. Fidelity's different than TD Ameritrade, et cetera, which is a huge headache for nonprofits.
And with this increase in the utilization, perhaps they were not prepared to have an increase in distributions to a wider number of charities, whereas they were plenty prepared to make the distribution to the owner of the IRA, but now there's more work and more effort to comply with their own rules in making those distributions to qualified charities.
Correct. My co-founder Jenny, who I spoke about earlier, is by all accounts brilliant. She was the top of her class at Harvard. She runs a team of amazing engineers here. It took her an hour and a half to get the right forms from Charles Schwab. And so you can imagine how hard it is for Jenny's grandmother.
Yeah. So are there things that you are doing to help streamline that from the major providers, or is this still something that's going to be something that every charity is going to have to tackle?
So we are, and we're fortunate. While I'm talking to you, we have an incredible group of engineers and product folks who are working on a new platform that will launch actually tomorrow, accumulates all of the top processes for each of the custodians and makes an hour and a half process for making a QCD about 4 minutes.
That's terrific. So will that be available at Freewheel, or is that a new site that you're telling us about today?
So folks can just go to freewheel.com and click on the nonprofits tab at the top, and we'll set you up with a walkthrough of the whole tools and share more information about that as well.
That's terrific. Now, when you say qualified, and the report is very specifically talking about qualified charitable deductions, distributions, that would tend to suggest that there are unqualified charitable distributions that would be disallowed. What is an unqualified charitable distribution that would not be allowed in the QCD world?
Great. It's a great question and an important one. So QCDs cannot go to donor advised funds, they cannot go to private foundations, and there's also a cap of $100,000. So giving beyond, you can give more than $100,000, but there's no tax benefit from that. And so you'll still have to pay ordinary income taxes on any amount over $100,000.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, and that is extremely important. So for like an organization like CAF America, which I serve as president and CEO, with expertise in moving funds internationally. So for donors who want to contribute to international causes and still qualify for a U.S. Tax deduction and have full compliance with other U.S. regulatory regimes in place for international transfer of funds, we host donor advised funds, but cannot accept AQCD entered donor advised funds, but we also have restricted funds for charities which are not donor advised funds, for which a QCD could be a qualified charitable distribution to a restricted fund, but would not be able to be accepted into a donor advised fund. So understanding those kinds of nuances as well are important for charities to protect their donors in not having an unqualified charitable distribution. So what are some of the key trends that you're seeing? Obviously, you've just identified, and tomorrow you're going to be launching an easy way for nonprofits to get the forms, an easy way for donors to be able to get the forms that are necessary. And how many of the larger IRA custodians will be represented and have their forms represented on this new link?
About 15. So the 15 largest will all be there.
All right. So again, you know, removing all of the excuses that charities might have and saying, again, this is really hard stuff. This is stuff I can't really understand or can't really help my donors. You really sort of can't afford to say that you're doing your job if you don't know what a qualified charitable distribution is, if you don't know that there's a new site launching tomorrow where you can find those forms so you don't have to spend, or your donors don't have to lose interest by spending an hour and a half to find those forms. And how does this tie into the potential of leaving a contribution via my will? Can I make arrangements in my will to direct a qualified charitable distribution from my IRA at the time of my passing?
Almost. So what it actually does is you'll identify your donors who make QCDs are the most likely to make you a beneficiary designee of your IRA, which is actually a separate process than a legal will in almost all states. But you can, if the folks that are routinely making QCDs year after year are a prime prospect for that conversation, and in many cases, IRAs can be quite sizable. So it's an incredibly important avenue that we think will actually take a big leap up alongside QCDs.
So the first step, if I understand, is to know where the forms are, be able to speak the language of QCD, and to help donors understand if you are a qualified charity that can accept a distribution. But when it comes to talking specifically to those donors about leaving those, that's a separate set of forms, not the same forms that will be on this link.
That's correct. And it's something that we may build future tools around because it's a big opportunity for nonprofits.
Right. But this is incremental. So I understand where you're going here is that, you know, starting off with the will itself, when 70% of Americans don't have a will, and only 5% of those who do have a will are leaving funds to charities, and very well may want to, because certainly there are more than 5% of Americans who are donors right now, who care about charities right now. So they may want to also have those charitable interests represented in their legacy documents. And then taking us to the next step to say, well, there's also something that is related to retirement, related to later life, 70 and a half, and that's this whole notion of IRAs, and that there are qualified charitable distributions, there's special forms, and so now you're building that out. So sort of the next step beyond that is, well, what happens when you marry those together? You have an IRA, and it is the end of your time, and you provide that will, then how do you make sure that you've got the proper documentation so that your wishes are able to be understood in your will?
Exactly.
So summarizing, bringing all this this together, going all the way back to the incredible work that you've done, that you've unlocked nearly $1 billion already, is that right? In new donations, new wills, working with charities, making that very easy. Well, what lies ahead for Patrick Smith, who's already made such a contribution? What are you seeing as some of the greatest needs when you have shown yourself to be someone who can take arguably some of the most complex parts of people's lives and give them philanthropic roadmaps?
Well, first I'll say what lies ahead for Patrick Schmidt is much more what lies ahead for our incredible team. There's 33 folks that we're working with today at Free Will, and most of them are dramatically smarter than I am. But when we look at the landscape together, actually, you know, let's step back to the campaign moments for a second. So we've seen a ton of innovation happening on small dollar giving, and a lot of this innovation is driven by political campaigns. You know, a lot of money, a lot of urgency, a lot of very smart people in a short amount of time. And so things like text to give and things like easy email forms and even giving, is the whole category of giving that's incredibly important that's been totally left behind because it has nothing to do with political campaigns. Planned giving, qualified charitable distributions. We think stock giving is an incredibly difficult process that many more people should be doing and they don't know how. And so that's another level of exploration for us. And we hope within 6 months that there's a lot more work we can do to support nonprofits to facilitate stock giving and things like donor advised funds, et cetera, et cetera. So we look at the more complex and the larger types of gifts that are dramatically larger and try to make them significantly easier, because in many ways it makes no sense that it's so much harder to give a $250,000 bequest than a $25 credit card donation.
Right, right. And I think that the nonprofit organizations who are the beneficiaries in many ways are also clueless as to how they can provide simple tools or answer questions in a way that provides useful information to those that are trying to do good with their will, with their IRAs, with other assets that they may have, because the rules can sometimes be daunting for both the donor and the charity. What does the future look like in that capacity?
I think a lot of nonprofits, and this is mostly true in planned giving, but also other areas of major gifts, where they feel like they either need to be good at everything to do anything, and that's a big mistake.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
85% of planned gifts are bequests. And so if you are not the American Heart Association, who we love, but has a lot more resources than many other organizations, start with bequests. If you're, you know, think about how to get a little bit better at accepting stock gifts or QCDs, and don't feel like you need to run your own annuity program. And so being unafraid of stepping forward, even if you're not going to do everything.
There are a lot of people that are out there who make a living being estate planners. Why do they avoid philanthropy as a discussion point when clearly a lot of Americans are philanthropic during their lifetime?
That's a great question, and I wish I had a better answer for you. I think in some cases, it's that they don't want to offend anybody else in the family by suggesting that not all the money goes to kids, nieces, nephews, grandkids. And part of it is that they just don't think about it. You know, there's a lot of things that go into estate planning that have nothing to do with charitable giving, and sometimes that just takes, you know, the whole conversation out.
Right. Well, it goes back to the sort of the age-old question of, you know, who he loves most or who she loves most. And, of course, the children, you know, want to believe that, you know, all of the funds, all the resources, the entire estate will benefit them. Doesn't mom or dad love me most? And to broach the subject of, there are causes that are dear, there are needs in the community, there are things that I do want to accomplish with some or all of my estate at the time of my passing, can oftentimes be a very emotional discussion.
That's right. But I think in our conversations with children, meaning adult children, they'll often be thrilled for 10% to go to a cause that was really important. It's not an all or nothing question, and people tend to forget that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you're quoted as saying that the human instinct to avoid thinking about death means that nearly 70% of Americans do not have an up-to-date legal will. So it's not just the charities that they're leaving behind, but their families as well, because of this you know, mental wanting to avoid the thought of death, but it can oftentimes lead to a lot of problems for the family and oftentimes catastrophic outcomes to your estate if you don't make your wishes clear.
That's definitely true. There's an estate planning crisis even outside of how it affects planned giving.
Right. So I think you're raising a very important point for the philanthropic sector in terms of the funds that very clearly you have shown. And I think what's wonderful about free will is that, you know, you started with a theory that you thought there were philanthropists out there, well-meaning people who would want to leave funds to charity if they had an easy way to account for that in their will. You've proven that with, you know, growing every day, but just shy of $1 billion of new funds that are released. And we know that those are new funds because these folks didn't have a will and now have a legal basis upon which their wishes can now be attended to when they pass. And that, there, you know, there's very few people who can say that they actually have allowed people, provided them with a pathway to accomplish what they would have liked to have accomplished, but for 70% of them, when they pass, those wishes would not be known, could not be adhered to.
Thank you. It's something we're really excited about doing on a day-to-day basis. And it's rare that you get to solve one problem by solving another, but that's how we think about our work.
That's right. In our final few moments here together, Patrick, would you summarize the strategy that you feel each of our listeners should employ from the listening of this podcast going forward, and then wrap up, we've got about 3 minutes here, wrap up with how can our listeners reach you and Free Will?
Great questions. So I'll just summarize to say that remembering that humans are humans, and we react to them. Humans need clear pathways that they understand the outcome even before they start, that making things easier will dramatically shift your own outcome. And you can see this in all the technology you use and all the work that Uber or Airbnb or Amazon are doing to help you spend money. You can apply those same principles to help people change the world. And the third is just a reminder that storytelling works. I mean, storytelling is our oldest form of communication, and understanding what people like me do on a daily basis is the number one guiding principle that most people use on actions. And so start to employ those principles, and I'd love to hear how they go for you. You can always reach us or anyone on the team at freewill.com. Even if you're interested in the demo, there's a link to our QCD report there as well, and we're happy to share that. And then you can reach me personally at patrick@freewill.com. We try to have big ears, and we've been really benefited by the advice and thoughtful wisdom and sometimes disagreement of people that we respect across the field. And it's been an incredible resource to us. We try to be intellectually curious and humble, and then use everyone's great ideas and build great technology that has real impact with those ideas.
One of my takeaways from what you've said today is, you know, don't necessarily focus on the outcome being the money, but focus on the outcome of people making a difference in their communities, telling that story and allowing them to know and understand and feel that they are part of something greater than just themselves by doing exactly what they've set out to do is a great way for every one of our listeners to take away from today and become far more successful in the work that they do for their organizations. Patrick Smith, thank you so much for being my guest here on the Nonprofit Coach. Thank you for bringing your innovation to the nonprofit sector, and we certainly look forward to having you back on the show as you release more and more easy to use, easy to understand, taking the complex and putting it in the hands of every American to make a difference in their communities. Thank you, Patrick.
Ted, thank you, and thanks for a great show.
You've been listening to the Nonprofit Coach Podcast with Ted Hart. Tell all your friends to check out our production schedule and download our iPod and iPad-friendly podcasts at tedhart.com. Thanks for listening to The Nonprofit Coach.